Hi, everybody. I'm Linda Tafazzoli, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey,
Linda. I love this. My sobriety date is October 26th of 1986, and that's always amazing to me. And my home group is the Big Book Topic Group, which meets on Friday nights at 7 in Hampton, Virginia. It is a closed discussion meeting, and it is a very active home group, which I am so grateful to be a part of. I've lived in several places, and I've been part of many groups. And this one is very special to my heart. It has grown and exploded, and we're just getting ready to start a beginner's meeting on Tuesday nights. And the enthusiasm of its members is just incredible. And there was a time when there were just four people meeting there on Friday nights, and we were lucky if we could fill an hour. And a lot of times we didn't. And then just the spirit of the people that came in charged it up, and it grew, and now it's fantastic to be a part of it and to see what's happening with it. So if you're in Hampton, please come and see us. I want to thank Billy for asking me to come. This drive today has been fantastic. I grew up in central New York. It's about an hour and a half from the Canadian border near the Thousand Islands, and the terrain looks just like this. It's a lot of dairy farms and hills, and Nicole and I were talking, and she's, you know, we're from Flatland down by the ocean, and she's just cracking up at how windy the roads are, and we're up and down and up and down, and it was bringing back memories, and I said, and I drove this 55, 60 miles an hour drunk in the snow, you know, without a problem at all. And now I'm, like, gripping the steering wheel and looking at, you know, the signs to see where I'm supposed to go. It's funny how you fall out of practice. But I'm here to tell you what my drinking was like, what happened, and what my life is like today. And what my life is like today has taken some turns, and that seems to be what comes out of my mouth, so I'm anxious to hear what I'm going to talk about today. But thanks a lot for asking me to come. I wouldn't have missed it. This great group of people, very warm, nice group of people here. Like I said, I grew up in central New York, and I am the youngest of four girls. My parents, we were not very well-to-do, but we had a home and heat and shelter, and there was always alcohol in my house all the time. It's very important. And my dad had a refrigerator in the basement that had a tap in the door and a half keg inside. You could pull the tap. You know, it was always ice-cold beer all the time. And it was very apparent to me from a very young age that alcohol was something that you did to liven things up. You get a drink, and there were parties, and my mother's family is all Irish Catholic, and they'd get together, and wow, it was great times. There was dancing and singing, and, you know, all sorts of things happened. But when my dad drank, he seemed to go a little farther than everybody else. There were things happening that frightened me very much. And I'm not saying that, you know, my parents were bad parents or anything like that. But I could see that the effects of alcohol on my dad were different than they were on everybody else. He got angry, and I got scared. That's what I remember. And he did things that he did when he was drunk that he wouldn't do when he wasn't. And on a regular basis, my sister and my mom and I would go out and dig his car out of the snowbank because he just couldn't seem to make it into the driveway. And, you know, I'd get real mad at him and think to myself, I am never, ever going to drink like that. And when I did drink, in my opinion, it was not like that. When I drank, I didn't get angry. And when I drank, I just lit up like a candle. Even from the very first time. I know there are people that, like, progressed into their alcoholism. And I think I drank for my, you know, very first time without being monitored. You know, like, you'll get a glass of wine or something at dinner, but that's all you get because there's grown-ups. But when I actually went out with my friends and bought liquor for the first time, there was not enough for me to have. I don't ever recall after that point drinking and thinking, well, I've had enough now. I fell down. I got hurt. I threw up. I did all sorts of things that my friend said, I don't want anymore, or look, you're getting out of hand, or you're not going to be able to come in my house like that. You know, you need to stop, all that kind of stuff. And I just couldn't. I didn't know that then. What I said to them then was, why would you want to stop? And why would I care if I can't come in your house? I'll sleep in the street, you know. There was always something to say to make you look like you were doing something wrong, because what I was doing was perfectly normal. And you were the one with the problem. And I would try to convince you of that unsuccessfully most of the time. When I was in high school, it was regular for me to, I didn't really care if I had a place to stay, because I was a girl, and I knew that there was a way that I could find a place to stay at the end of the night. So I'd tell my mom and dad, I need to go to church, and they'd drop me off in front of the Catholic church at 5 o'clock on a Saturday evening. I'd go in, I'd sit there and say, God, forgive me for what I'm about to do. They'd all go up for communion, and I hauled out the door and walked down to a friend's house, and we'd hitchhike down to this bar. Gosh, I almost had the name of it on the tip of my tongue. Petticoat Junction. Woo! We'd hitchhike down there, and there'd be live music and stuff. And the drinking age then was 18, and we'd just get slaughtered and, you know, find some young gentleman that would take us home, and we'd, you know, sleep there for the night and get a ride back in the next morning. And I got caught doing that. Or I'd just wander around and sleep on your porch. One time I lived in a small community like this. I don't know if y'all lock your doors, but they didn't. And I came to, and somebody was saying, get out, you know. And it was a person I happened to know, a young man, and I realized I had entered the wrong house. And I'd woken up in people's houses, you know, when I was 16 and 17 years old, and people were so kind to me. This is just blows me away today. I smashed the coffee table at a party I was at, and I woke up in the parents' bed. And when I came downstairs, they had breakfast ready for me. And they said, young lady, we thought maybe we could talk about your drinking. And I remember distinctly lighting a cigarette in their kitchen while they're going to have breakfast and saying, see you later. After I'd, you know, terrified these people. And I didn't even realize what I had done until I heard another couple describe what happened to them when they had someone that their son brought home and stayed in their house, and they were just terrified he was going to, you know, murder them all in their sleep. And I couldn't imagine what these people thought about me. And they were said that they were afraid to wake me up and ask me to leave their bed. I can't imagine. I hope I don't ever have to imagine, but, you know, if one of my kids brings somebody home, or my husband or myself, you know, these are the things that I'm willing to do. I've been in that situation. So that's, you know, the kinds of things that were going on in my early drinking career. I started getting arrested for drunk driving. And for my second DWI, I was facing jail and heavy fines. And my family was pretty much ready to wash their hands of me. By then, I'm calling them at midnight and crying and saying, I love you. And, you know, all I want is just a shred that they would still accept me in their life, and I wasn't getting anything. I had this really great hotshot boyfriend that had a family business in our town. He had the family had money, and We were living in this really strange apartment, and he sold cocaine on the side, and which I was introduced to, and it was wonderful because it allowed me to drink for days and days. It wasn't that I loved the drug, but from the very first time I did it, I knew that I was starting to slip into that spot where you're drinking and you're starting to get sloppy. I mean, that always happened for me, but this could bring me back long enough where I could keep drinking. And so I loved it. And I don't ever remember buying it, but every time I could find it, get my hands on it, I did it. And so I was living with this guy, and during that time, and facing, you know, going to jail, and he got me a really great lawyer, and I didn't end up having to go, but I had to go to counseling, and I was on probation for 5 years. And during that time, and they said, you cannot drink. And my lawyer told me before I went to court, don't drink. Because if anybody sees you drinking or you get in trouble for drinking now, you're definitely going to jail and there's nothing I can do for you. And I'd say, okay. And I'd go across the street to the little luncheonette where all the lawyers and cops and everybody, and drink during lunch. I just didn't, I'm thinking now, I just didn't get it. When they said don't drink, that meant like don't get sloppy in public or don't drink and drive or something like that. It didn't mean no alcohol, period. So I continued to drink, and I really truly wanted to stop. I did not want to shame my family with the things that I was doing. My parents really were disgusted. They didn't want to talk to me anymore. I had a job that I was on probation for that too. I worked for the state of New York at an alcohol treatment center, and in the morning, I worked at 6, or I'd have to be there at 5:30 a.m., and I was done at 9:30 a.m., and I would serve breakfast to the people that were in this. It was like a 60-day program, and I would stink of booze. I'd come in, and they would look at me, and I would think, gosh, why do they hate me so much? They don't even know me, you know, and I would serve their little oatmeal and stuff in the morning, and they were really mean to me. That's all I can remember. but I had that job, and I was risking losing that when, you know, if you get a federal government job or any kind of government job, you really have to do something bad, like shoot somebody or go to jail in order to lose it. But I had called in sick so many times, and, you know, little did I know that they knew about my drinking. And so I was, you know, showing up for work and showing up for court and trying very hard not to drink. And I couldn't do it. And I was asked to go to this counselor, and I lied, and I said, no, I only drink a couple here and there, and I don't do any drugs, and I don't have any difficulties in my relationships with my family or my boyfriend or anybody, you know, and a big smile, and everything's fine. And so he suggested I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I went to my very first meeting. It was in the city, you know, because I lived in a very rural part of New York, and my mother drove me there because I didn't have a license, and I was just humiliated that my mother would have to drive me to the AA meeting, and she brought me really early, and I went in the door. It was right across from Stanley's Bar, which was this real dive. You know, I'm saying it's a real dive, which is a joke, and so I went in, and there was this old man named Frank, and Frank had a hole in his head right here, and he didn't have any hair. He had like this sweeping hair thing, and he looked at me and he said, young lady, if you keep drinking, you're going to look just like me. And I thought, oh my God. And it was all sunken in, and then later I found out that Frank had shot himself in the head and lived, and that got my attention. Because I really wanted to die. I would pray in the morning and at night, God, just take my life. Because I didn't turn my back on God, but I knew God didn't want anything to do with me. Because if he did, he wouldn't be making my life such the hell that it was. You know, it wasn't my fault. God was just, you know, making me go through all this stuff. So I go to this meeting, and all I remember is Frank, and that everything was yellow, and it was really smoky. And I remember then you could, like, smoke 3 cigarettes a meeting. It was an hour. It's like a good meeting if it was a 3-cigarette meeting. You know, if it was more, maybe it wasn't such a good meeting. But and in the beginning of going to meetings, I remember I could never sit for an hour. Never. I would have to get up and get coffee. I'd have to go outside. I did whatever I could because I was just ready to, you know, my nerves were just on edge. I hated it there. I'm not one of those people that walked into Alcoholics Anonymous and went, oh, I'm home. I couldn't stand any of it. The people were old. The place was dirty. You know, all of a sudden I became glamour girl or something. Like, I didn't belong there. And, you know, I went home and with my mother, and I went back to the counselor, and I said, well, I'm not going back there ever again. And he said, well, why not? And I said, because they prayed, and I'm an atheist. All of a sudden, I just became one. And, you know, I wanted somewhere else to go because I don't want to be with these people. And he said, why don't you go back and try it again? And I did. I did not go frequently. He asked me to go once a week, and I went. Because I really thought that you people, or some of you, worked for the motor vehicle department, and you were like going to tell people that you saw Linda there, and you're going to give the report, and then I can get my license back. And so that's why I went. And the other, it was humiliating for me to call my mother and ask her to drive me to the AA meeting. Like, it wasn't humiliating to, you know, find out that I was being escorted out of a bar because I had taken my clothes off and I came to and I didn't remember what happened. That was okay. But it was humiliating for me to have to ask my mother to take me to the AA meeting. There were many things that now I look at it and it was completely humiliating, my behavior. But it was okay because everybody lived like that as far as I was concerned. And you just didn't know how to have a good time. I worked in a country club where my hotshot boyfriend was a member. And I would just get sloppy drunk and walk up to these people in their fur coats and stuff and start singing and dancing. And, you know, they would just be looking at me like I had 3 heads. Get her out of here. And I'd be thinking, they just don't know what fun is, you know. But that was okay. That's really what I believe. You just don't know how to have a good time like I do. You know, you're living a sheltered life, baby. So anyways, that's the lies that I tell myself in my drinking. And things are looking pretty bleak. The boyfriend's not coming home anymore. I don't have transportation. I don't have any friends left. My family's turned their back on me. And I'm sitting in this apartment with the remote control to a little television at night, just sitting there drinking and not wanting to drink. I didn't have a supply of drugs anymore coming home at night so that I could continue to drink and try to straighten up and go to work. I wasn't doing much of anything but sitting alone in that apartment and drinking. Once in a while, I'd get real drunk and I'd walk down into town and try to pick a fight with somebody or something, but mostly I stayed home alone and thought about, you know, is this the way my life is going to be? I'm just going to sit here. And that's the loneliness and despair that I just couldn't stand. And I was too chicken to kill myself. And I picked a fight with this boyfriend one more time because I was too drunk to walk down the sidewalk, so I knew he would want me to drive his truck home so that I wouldn't embarrass myself. And that was the last time that I got drunk. And the next day, he had asked me to leave, and I actually did. I'd been asked to leave many, many times before, and I didn't. And I went back to my parents' house, and I'd used, you know, several other substances, whatever you gave me, I just took it. And so I had some Valium, and I took that during this time when I was alone in my parents' house, drying out and looking at my face in the mirror and my skin looking green. And I thought I was just a witch or the devil himself. I just, you know, my skin was crawling. I couldn't eat. And my parents had some liquor in the house, and I remember just standing there in front of it and thinking, you can drink that. And then I'd turn around and walk up the stairs. And only by the grace of God that I didn't. I had a strong desire not to drink at that point, but I didn't know what else to do. And I slept a lot. And people told me later that my, you know, your skin turns green when you're drying out, and that was normal. So I, you know, found out that I wasn't the devil or the exorcist or anything like that. But that was a decision that I had made that I wanted to stop drinking. My parents came home and found me in their house, and I thought they were going to throw me out and say, no way, that's a hotshot boyfriend. He's got money. You need to keep him. Go on back there. But they didn't. And for the first time, I remember that my dad and my mom told me they loved me and they wanted me to stay there as long as I needed to. And shortly after that, I got my license back and I was able to drive to AA meetings on my own. It was a really cool thing. And I had like a car. I wish I could remember what kind it was. It was orange, though. Oh, it was awesome. It was like something Brougham. Oh, a Matador Brougham, whatever that is. And it had a really nice stereo. But my insurance was $1,500, and I think the car cost like $300. It was hysterical. And I really resented that insurance company for that. But I was able to drive to meetings, and I went to this young people's meeting a lot because, you know, the reason I didn't belong in AA was because you were all old and you were all men. And at this meeting, some of the people were younger, and, you know, I was 23 years old, and they did things. They went bowling. They went out for coffee. They, like, every Saturday afternoon when the meeting was over, they went out and did something fun. And I hadn't had fun in a really long time. I said, hey, let's go fishing, but first we'll go have a couple of drinks, and we never left the bar. You know, my idea of fun was we'll go to the bar and talk about what we're going to do. I never did any of it. So now I'm starting to be with people long enough. I mean, I really would think if I have to sit here 5 more minutes, I'm just going to jump out of my skin. They seem to be able to be together comfortably, and I just didn't, I couldn't do it. I'd say, sure, I'll go to the picnic, and I'd sit there and smoke 10 cigarettes, you know, and for however long that took me, drink a lot of Coke, and then I'd go, okay, I got to go. And then I'd go home and sit there by myself and cry and wonder, why can't I do what they're doing? You know, I just could not be with people. I didn't know how to do that. So, you know, little by little, as long as they were doing something active, I could stay. But if you were all just going to sit and talk or play cards or something, have to look eyeball to eyeball, I just couldn't do it. I was just terrified of you. You seemed to have it all together, and I didn't. And I knew that you knew that I didn't. And where I got sober is kind of a... They think nothing of confrontation, let's just put it that way. If they don't think that you're doing what they think you ought to be doing, they'll let you know quickly and not very gently. And I was in a meeting, and I was going, talking my little spiel about how I knew when I needed to go to meetings, and this girl just cut me off and said, you don't know shit. You need to just keep your mouth shut. And I thought, I am never, ever going to talk to her again in my life. I hate her. And I'm never coming back to this meeting, you know. So her name was Betsy, and she became my sponsor like a year later. And she was wonderful. She was a get-in-your-car kind of gal, you know. She was the DCM. She seemed to be respected by the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the way, I only went to that one meeting. They had 3 meetings a day in this clubhouse. And that's the only place I went. People would say, why don't you go over here or go over here? And I'd say, nope, I know the people here. And, you know, I was starting to get comfortable. And I'm starting to learn the jargon. And I'm starting to learn how to talk what you people are talking. And that's it. I finally have a sponsor, so these 2 guys will get off my back and stop asking me if I have one. And And I'm riding around in the car with Betsy, and we're doing some stuff. And during that time also, like in the second year of being dry, I got to work on a convention, a young people's state convention. And it was just pure chaos. I mean, they'd say, you're the committee chair. And I didn't know what I was doing. And I didn't know what to do. And I never even showed up. And then they'd call me and say, hey, Linda, are you going to show up? Oh, yeah, sure. And then I wouldn't. You know, and then all of a sudden this thing happened. And I didn't have a thing to do with it, but I had a really good time when I was there. It was just pure a fluke that the thing came off the way it did, I think. But there were some people that worked really, really hard to make it happen, and it was an awful lot of fun, and they had great speakers. So that was my very first convention, and I thought that's, you know, what it was going to be like, a little AA service. But I didn't have any problem saying to somebody, yeah, I'm the chairperson of the hospitality committee for this thing, and I didn't do nothing. So I'm, you know, starting to steal from Alcoholics Anonymous already. I want a little prestige. And some people said you should get a home group. And so I joined another group, not the one that I was part of, and went out and got a real home group at noon, and I immediately became the alternate GSR of that group. I didn't know what it was. And they said, oh, you just show up and at the meeting, and we only meet for like 5 minutes, and it's great. And we had a bowling league in that group. And I think that's all we did. There wasn't much AA going on there. Truly not much AA going on there at all, even during the meeting. But that's what I was attracted to. And so I did that. And during this time, there were some people that came in to meetings that around the same time that I did. And I started to notice things about them that were not the same as me. See, I was still going home because I couldn't sit eyeball to eyeball with you. We could not have coffee or dinner or anything where you'd have to sit. And there was a group of women that would go out after a 5:30 meeting all the time for dinner. And they would even ask me to come, and I couldn't go. When I got up in the morning, I had to drink as much coffee as I could possibly get into my system. And then I'd show up at the meeting and my hands would be shaking and I couldn't think straight. And, you know, I was just doing whatever I had to do in order to show up and try to look like I was okay. And I wasn't doing a very good job of it. So I saw these other people and they start talking about, they seemed calmer, and they're talking about, working the steps. Which I figure you just, you know, I did that. You look at it, you read it, and you say, yeah, I did that. I did, you know, I know I already have a God. It doesn't matter. And I took my inventory in my head, and I said I was sorry to some people, and that's all I need to do. And I'm showing up at meetings. That's 12-step work, right? And in my head, I was okay. And Betsy and I were still driving around, you know, doing her DCM thing, and she took me to a lot of funerals, and I didn't get this for a really long time, and I hate to bore the people who've heard this story, but we'd go to these funerals. We'd drive like 4 hours to get there sometimes, and we'd walk through the line of people in front of the casket. And I'd shake the hands of these people that would just be in tears and broken and say that I'm sorry for their loss. And I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't really care that I was there. And I didn't even really want to go with Betsy. And then years later, I realized what she was doing. She was showing me that people die of alcoholism. And I'm getting the opportunity to look in the faces of these family members, and I never even knew what was going on. But it's just as powerful for me right now to think about what she had given me, and I never even knew it. So that's what was going on in the first couple of years of sobriety. It was right around my third year anniversary. Betsy moved away, and I got a new sponsor, and it all seemed like to happen in a week's time. But I had gotten back together with the hotshot boyfriend because he lost his leg in a motorcycle accident, so he was now my captive prisoner. He couldn't get away, literally. And so we spent 3 years trying to make that work. And that's the other piece of, you know, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm trying to be with you people. And here I am living with a guy who's drinking and snorting cocaine. And I'm trying to make this relationship work, and it won't. And I'm walking into that AA meeting, and I'm trying to be all right. And I'm not. And all I want is to be respected and loved by you. I have absolutely nothing to give. Nothing at all. I'm just an empty person trying to manage my life, and it's falling apart all around me. So I got this new sponsor, and I move out of, I call him the one-legged man now affectionately, and I move out from there, and for the first time, I got an apartment, and I had nothing. But it seemed like all in one day I had a TV, a bed, a sofa, a coffee pot. You know, I had stuff that people in Alcoholics Anonymous just showed up on my doorstep and gave me. All in a day's time. And it was incredible to me. And I knew that this was the right thing to do. There was no question about it. But I didn't have a penny to my name, and it was cold. It was November, and I had another home group now. One that I regularly attended. It was at a 5:30 meeting, and it was closed. And prior to, well, I think maybe I was still doing this now, but I'd like to go there and call myself an addict just to piss this old lady off that went there, because she just, you know, it would send her for a loop. And because I had used drugs, and I really thought that I was. I didn't know, you know, everybody said, it's all one thing. And I said, well, okay, then why do we have to separate? And I asked all kinds of questions, and I would just infuriate these people that I didn't really like anyway. And that was kind of a bonus for me. So I went to that meeting that night, and I just remember thinking, I'm cold, I'm lonely, I don't have a thing to eat in my house, I have no money. I'm going to go to this meeting, I'm going to have a couple of cookies and a cup of coffee, and I'm going to go back there and be cold and lonely again. And for the very first time, there was a guy there that I had known from that meeting, and I'd met his wife, and she used to cook big casseroles and stuff when we'd have potluck dinners. And he was there, and I sat down next to him, and I said, I just moved today, and I don't have anything to eat. Do you think it would be all right if I came home with you after the meeting and maybe had something to eat with you and Sam? And he said, absolutely. And I had never asked anybody for anything in my life, and they just embraced me. And they took me in their home, and they fed me a meal and sent me on my way home. And I just thought I was about, you know, going to die to ask this person for something to eat. I'd never asked anybody for anything. I had all the answers. I knew what I was doing. I wasn't going to ask for anything. And I realized at that time that, you know, this is not a place where people are going to feed me and give me handouts or anything like that, but I truly had a need. And I asked for it, and it was met with no questions asked. And so I'd go back to that meeting. It was like Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And I met my sponsor there named Joanne. And I asked her to sponsor me, and she said, well, Linda, I'd be honored. And nobody'd ever said anything like that to me before in my life. And she said, well, where are you in the steps? And I said, well, I'm on the 8th step, because that sounded really good. I'm 3 years sober, 8, that sounds good, 8 out of 12, you know, kind of on the high end. And I said, but I'm having trouble with it. And she said, really, you're having trouble with your list or being willing? What is it? And I said, oh, well, both. And so she said, well, why don't you call me tonight? And I did. And she asked me, why don't we start at the beginning of the book, and we'll start at the first step. And I remember thinking, the first step? I've been sober 3 years. Blah, blah, blah. You know, my head starts spinning, and I said, okay. And that's when my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous really, truly began. And I, to the best of my ability, with the brain, as crazy as it was at that time, went through the 12 steps with Joanne, through the big book, and started, you know, with the doctor's opinion and found out what I was. And that was probably the biggest gift to me of all. Because when we went through and talked about the phenomenon of craving, did I have that with alcohol? Oh, yeah. When I started to drink, something wonderful happened for me, and I could not physically stop until I passed out or I just couldn't drink anymore. It didn't matter if there wasn't any more either, because there were some things that I did to get some more. But I clearly saw that I had the allergy to alcohol. And then when I applied that to all the other drugs that I had used, I didn't have that. Even with the cocaine, I did that one time without any booze, and I said, I don't ever want to touch that stuff again as long as I live. I thought I was going to have a heart attack. I hated it. And I really didn't like any of the other stuff either. So I was given a gift, going through the doctor's opinion of knowing actually where I belonged. And I was an alcoholic, and I didn't have to go back to my home group anymore and say anything about being an addict. But what happened during that time, too, was this guy moved into town, and he was kind of stealing my thunder, because it was like, you know, all about Linda. I just moved. I had all this drama going on, out of a relationship, and really good things are happening for me. I got a new sponsor. I got a new job. Things are good. And this guy's there whining and crying about living in New York, and it's cold, and he's from Virginia, and he doesn't like it there, and blah, blah, blah. And he's so annoying. But I felt sorry for him, and I asked him to come out to eat with a group of people, and he thought I was asking him to come, you know, out with me and eat with me, and, you know, we were just hooking up or something, and it wasn't that way. And he was also very blunt, which most of the people in New York were, but I just wasn't used to that. I was used to charming you up, you poor guys. You know, you give me what I want. If you're not going to do that, I can figure it out pretty quick, and I'm on my way. But I couldn't figure anything out with this guy, and I didn't like it. And I was kind of interested in that, too. Where's his deal? And I'm going to find out, you know, I'm going to embarrass him. I'm going to do something. And my sponsor had said, you know, Linda, you need to just keep your pants on for 90 days. That's all I'm asking. And I said, no sweat, you know. I've been with this guy for 6 years. My heart's broken. And, you know, 89 days later, me and this new guy are... He wasn't new in sobriety, but me and this guy were hooked up and, you know, madly in love. And I married him a couple years later. So I always say, that's okay, because I married him. But during that time of going through the steps with Joanne and being with this guy that I couldn't manage or work him or, you know, he was the... I'd try to start a little drama with him and... He'd say, why don't you talk to your sponsor about that? And boy, that would piss me off. Because I couldn't even get a reaction from the guy. He just wasn't going to play my games. And I wasn't used to that sort of thing at all. So I really, truly did work with my sponsor. And we had a wonderful experience of going through the big book. A lot of times it was over the telephone, too. Because she had a really great job and wasn't always available to sit down with me personally. But that was okay, too. And, you know, we went through the second step, and I saw a lot of things, you know, just the insanity of the way that I was trying to manage my life. And not just, you know, my drinking. I saw all kinds of stuff about myself and my insanity and what I would try to do and use and get in order to make myself feel better, because, God, I want to feel good all the time. And, excuse me. Seeing where my prejudices lied with organized religion, mostly. I didn't really have a problem with God, but I wasn't going near any of that other stuff. And, you know, good thing I didn't have to. But there was a lot of prejudice that I had against, you know, people in Alcoholics Anonymous just because of who you were. I found out that there was a guy in my home group, he was a lawyer, and immediately, you know, I don't want anything to do with him. You got money? Get away from me. You know, all that stuff that I had built up over the years because of old ideas that I had, and I would cut you out before I even, you know, got to know what your name was. And just setting that stuff aside and getting to experience that it didn't matter who you were or what you had or what you did or how far down you went in order to get here. We all drink, you know, the same way, and we all experience the same things. And again, I feel like, God, I'm in the right place, and this is good. And we did the third step together, and she made me circle and underline that paragraph that says selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our troubles. And I couldn't figure out why, because I had given my life for everyone. And she said, we'll get to that. And, you know, reading about the actor and all that stuff, and I began to see that I didn't do anything for free. Nothing. I wanted something from you all the time. I wasn't even aware of how far that went. And still, today, it's amazing to me how selfish I am to the core. I can try and do and do and do. But even, you know, when my motives are so good and I'm trying to help you, I'm still trying to steal something from you. And the only way that that doesn't happen is if, you know, God has just placed me somewhere and used me, and then I'm all done, and I go, wow, that was fantastic. I didn't have a thing to do with it. It was great, because I will always try to get in there and get something. I did my fourth step with her. I took forever writing it down, and it was... You know, I was really afraid to do my fifth step because I was sure she wasn't going to like me anymore. She wasn't going to want to be around me. And everyone I knew, I was one of those polling people, you know. I mean, go to the meeting and take a poll and see what everybody else says about it. And then maybe I'll go through with it. But everybody else said, yeah, yeah, you do it. I felt like that too. Don't worry about it. And we sat in the park one day. And I did my first fifth step and I read it to her. And... you know, we laughed, we cried. It was a wonderful time, and I remember physically feeling like I got hit by a truck. My body was just completely dead, and but I felt wonderful. I felt lighter, and I went back home, and I was getting ready to go spend the weekend with a bunch of AA folks. And I, during that quiet hour, I looked in my face in the mirror, and I saw that light in my eyes that I saw in those other people. And I don't know if I'd ever seen it since, but I saw it that day, and I overwhelmingly had the feeling that God was going to take care of stuff from here, and he didn't need my help. And that it was going to be okay. And I'd never felt like that before. And then immediately, you know, the next day I launched out into trying to manage my own life again. But, by doing my amends. And, you know, I realized what tipped her off to me not being on the eighth step after, you know, we sat down in the park that day, immediately went through six and seven, and we did the seventh step prayer together before she sent me home. I say she sent me home like she was, you know, my keeper or something, but that's, you know, we parted. And my list came from my fourth step, from my resentment list and my fear list. And there were other things added to that of things that I had done, and I owed some, you know, I had some credit card debt, and that went on there too. But mostly it was the resentment, and nothing got taken off, much to my dismay, because there were things still that I just didn't understand, and I asked her, why is this here and why is this here? And she said, I don't know what God has for you there, Linda. I just don't. So we're not going to take anything off. And I immediately chose an ex-boyfriend to go out and make amends to. You know, she said, you might want to start with your parents. And I thought, nah, this will be much better, the ex-boyfriend. And he had spent time in the psychiatric hospital that I worked at. He was schizophrenic, and he, you know, when he was on his medication, he was a great guy. But when he wasn't taking it, and he would like have a ceremony and burn my clothes on the lawn and stuff, and talk to the television when there was snow in it and everything. And it's not really funny because it's a horrible disease to have, but. But I loved him, and I wanted to marry him. I mean, like, none of that stuff mattered to me. And so I go back to see him, and I tell him that I was, you know, that I was wrong, and the things that he had accused me of and suspected were absolutely true, and I had lied to him, and blah, blah, blah. You know, so I make this huge mess. The guy, you know, starts sending weird things to my house and showing up in the hallway at my job, I had to take some steps to make sure that those things weren't going to continue to happen anymore, you know. And then I call my sponsor and go, oh, my God, what do I do? This is happening. And she said, Linda, let's talk about this first before you go on to the next one. And I did, but I had a lot of therapy, too. I need to say that. In the beginning, you know, with the counselor, and I never stopped. I love therapy. I absolutely love it. It allowed me to not be part of Alcoholics Anonymous in the best way, because I could pay this person over here, tell him all my horrible little secrets. I never had to say anything to anybody in AA. Like, you're going through all this stuff and talking about it, and I'm just taking it all in, and then I go over here and pay this person and tell him my stuff. So they had described to me things that I should do someday when I was ready and confront some people. So according to me and my amends, you know, I'm going to go confront these people and tell them, look, I'm just not going to take it anymore. And I destroyed my relationship with my sister and her husband for quite some time. And it's only by God's grace and these 12 steps and that immense process that we're even speaking to each other today, because we do get another opportunity if they're willing to sit down with people. And so, you know, it's just been a process for me. And it took another few years before I actually got into 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis. I went to a big book workshop when we moved to Pensacola, Florida. And 26 weeks, we all showed up on a Sunday afternoon for 2.5 hours with this guy and went through the big book. There were like 40 people. It was an amazing experience to have. And, you know, we all went through them, 1 through 12, all over again. And that's when I started asking people about, what's your meditation like? Because I hadn't seriously even tried it. And somebody told me, it's anything that takes you out of yourself. So, you know, I tried, like, dancing to loud music and walking and, you know, stuff that is that I could participate in actively. Because I don't know, you could probably tell. I'm very energetic, and my mind is always working, always. So to sit quietly would not be my first choice for anything. But that's what this person told me. He said, I sit quietly for 20 minutes. And I said, oh, my gosh, I can never do that. And he said, well, I started with five minutes. And it seems like a really long time, but if you set your microwave timer and sit down in the chair, just try it for a little while. And I began to experience some of that, the promises that they talk about in the 11th step with not being so excited and not being so frightened. And just, I can never quote the big book when I'm standing up here, but I think I can do it better when we're sitting in the car. But anyways, I start to experience some real emotional I don't even want to say it was stability, but emotionally and even physically, I started to slow down and calm down. And maybe I didn't recognize it as much as the people around me did. And, you know, I'm married, and we now have a little boy. And my husband had asked me to stay home and take care of him, because we had put him in a daycare center when he was about 9 months old. And I said, no, absolutely not. And the reason for that was because I was not going to have to ask him for money. And I told him that. I will not ask you for money. I need my own life and my own this and my. And then I sat morning after morning in that quiet time. And I knew how selfish I was being. And I was just about fighting with God. And I'm trying to be quiet. And I'm thinking, I don't have what it takes to do this. And I began to hear, I know some people say you're crazy if you're hearing voices, but this voice that I hear, not out loud, not this booming voice, it sounds like my dad. And that voice to say, I'll give you what you need. And start to trust that I don't have everything that it takes to make it through the day, but with God's help, I can. And so I said, okay. And I quit my job, and I stayed home with my son. And my other thing was financially, we just can't do it. And like a month after that, the mortgage company sent us a letter and said, we've been charging you too much for your escrow. Here's $100 a month back, and you don't have to pay this much anymore. It was lowered like $100 a month. And then I knew, you know, I'm always looking for the evidence. And, you know, God has this fantastic way of, you know, I don't think he makes me wait. He's got perfect timing. And I wasn't even waiting for that. But I was waiting for the evidence to say to my husband, you were wrong. This cannot be done. And I had nothing. It could be done. And it was being done. And gosh, I wouldn't have given that up for the world. But I'm not a great mom. And I will continue to tell you, I do not have what it takes to be a loving, wonderful mother or a wife. I have not been either one of those things. I have been the exact opposite a lot of times. It is so important to me to look spiritual and sober in front of you, much more than it was important for me to provide a loving, happy household for a husband and some children. I am so selfish that all I really cared about was getting a little recognition from my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous while my family's going to hell. You know, they were hiding literally when I came in the door. I'd go to the meeting and talk my crap, and somebody would say to me, you know, who do you think you are? And I'd go home and just rant and rave to my husband and my son. And I found out I was pregnant about 4.5 years ago. And all I could think of was, oh, my God, my life is over. How could God do this to me? You know, it wasn't a joyous moment for me. I knew I was about to be 40. And all I could think about was I wanted a rest. I want to enjoy some retirement. I want this. I want that. And I sunk into the most self-centered depression that I have ever had. Before that, I would swear to you, I'd never been depressed in my life. Now, all of a sudden, my life's coming crashing down. And you know, there's just crap. I can't do anything. I can't go to meetings as much as I did before because I physically can't handle it. And I'm thinking about all this stuff that I can't do and I can't have. And I'm, you know, just completely self-absorbed. And I'm saying to my doctor as I go for my little appointments, I'm depressed. And she said, well, let me put you on this stuff. And I said, no, I don't want that. And the only thing that truly kept me from doing that was because I knew that my sponsor said, if you're going to do that, I cannot be your sponsor. That was it. I wanted to get put away, shut up, locked up, anything that would keep me, because this is the best I got. I go home and I scream and yell at this poor little child, tell him he doesn't love his mother, and I can't give anything to my husband, and I got 15 years of sobriety. I got nothing to give you, And I can't even steal from you anymore because you think I'm pathetic. And all I want to do is get put away. And I can't do it. My sponsor is dying of cancer. He's just been told he's got 6 weeks to live. You know, and in my head, all I can think about is me. All this is happening to me. And I had this baby. And I began to feel this lift, this selfish, self-centered, if you want to call it, I called it depression because we do experience that. But it began to lift and I felt it happening. And I truly believe it was a result of taking care of this child, because prior to that I had nothing to do but think about me and what I needed and what I wanted. And this child has been the joy of my life. And I would have missed it if I had tried any other method to stay sober. I continued to go to jail and meet with this guy on a weekly basis because he truly wanted what I had and nobody else did. And I don't blame him because I was just a mess. But this guy in jail seemed to think that, you know, we could continue to work together, and I'd walk in there with my big old belly, and, you know, I felt normal and okay when I walked into that jail. And I would not give up AA service work for any reason at all. And I can't think of any good reason now. It saved my life. And I know I'm out of time, but my sponsor got free of cancer. And my family, as a result of my husband hanging in there, I don't know how he did it. He could have had me put in jail for assault. It got that bad for me. I mean, I hit him, and I would have attacked him just for, you know, confronting me or anything. I just had no control whatsoever over what I was going to do. And so he hung in there, and God helped me to wake up again and see, you know, all the opportunities that are out there for me to give to people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how to give so much to my children, but boy, do I know how to give here. And I sometimes think, why in the world would anybody want to listen to this crap that I have to say? It sounds so depressing, or, you know, it was to me in my life. But gosh, all that happened, and my life today is so incredibly different. And I wouldn't trade what happened for the world. I wish I didn't have to hurt my husband and my son. I really do. But they've given me the opportunity to make that right. And the least little thing that I can do every day when my husband comes in the door and I say, "Hi, honey, I'm glad you're home. How was your day?" And he just lights up like somebody handed him, you know, some Craftsman tools. And if that's all I got to do, I can do that. And I can show up and keep coming here, and I can do whatever you ask me to do. And that's all there is to it right now. And I continue to try to practice these principles in all my affairs, and I surely am not perfect at it or even good at it. But I'm going to keep trying because I don't even want to say the rewards of it, but what I get to see and get to experience as a result of it is just incredible. And I thank you for listening.